Even the best trained dog can get spooked by something and run off, and a cat that spent its entire life indoors might just slip away one day. And these situations, of course, they're rare. It's still important to have a way to track them down so you and I know they can come home safely and healthy and happy. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we are joined by Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She takes some time every month to spend with us to give us advice on keeping the pets healthy and happy. And today, one of the things she'll be talking about is microchipping our pets. Dr. Sandy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
Want to give our listeners a chance to join in? You can call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. August 15th is Check the Chip Day. And what does that really mean to microchip a pet?
Well, the AVMA has put this day aside to say just, you know, bring awareness to microchipping. And microchips are a little tiny thing that's about the size of a grain of rice that it just sits there very inert in the dog's body, but it has a unique number encrypted in it. I kind of look at it as kind of like the UPC symbols on your box of cereal, okay? Mm-hmm. And that chip has to be, you know, that every chip has an individual number. Most of them are going to have about 15 numbers on it, especially if you're going to be taking your pet overseas. You do need to have one that is quite a long number, but doesn't mean the chip's any bigger at all. And one of the problems that I see as a veterinarian is people move and they don't update the information in the database. It would be like the grocery store having an item on the shelf that they have not programmed that into their cash registers so that it's not recognized. And so you scan it and this number comes up, but they can't link it to what that product is. So if you kind of look at it the same way with pets, you do need to make sure that the chip is readable and that the information in the database is there and correct. There is a way of checking to see if your chip is registered and if the information is there. And if you just go to a Google microchip lookup, and it's a website that is sponsored by the American Animal Hospital Association. You put in the microchip number of your pet, and then you can find out who the company is and an 800 number to call so you can double check to make sure that they've got all the information you need to be able to get your pet back to you safely. I check a chip every time a pet comes in for a wellness appointment. If they're microchipped, we scan them to make sure that it's readable. Mm. I've had, fortunately, it's very uncommon, but sometimes chips become unreadable and something's happened and the owners, you know, doesn't realize it because most people don't have their own scanners at home. And companies are very good at replacing microchips at no cost if you do have one that is lost and unreadable. So, yeah.
And then there's a central database then for all this information?
Or? Well, that is one of the concerns, is that this is where this microchip lookup site is helpful, because that is a kind of universal database that's able to then trace that chip back to who the company is that made it, so that they can then check to see who it's been registered under.
Okay.
And so even though each microchip company usually has their own registration service, you can still get to it through this microchip lookup site.
Joel in Milwaukee has, I think, a related question. Joel, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have actually a two-part question. The first part, which is, you know, I have my little Lulu, and she's a Maltese toy poodle, a little multi-poo.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that, you know, is it possible for them to put some kind of navigation device in a chip so that you could maybe download an app, and if your dog were to disappear, you could navigate it?
Well, that's a really good idea, although the size of the thing that you would have to implant in the dog would be too large. But they do make something called the Tag, T-A-G-G, runs about $100, and it's actually is a small unit that attaches to the dog's collar and is a GPS unit that you can then link to your smartphone, and you can follow where your pet is going. And, you know, it just shows you just like you would like your phone when you're, you know, on one of the map things, you can find out where you're at on a map easily enough. And the same thing happens with the pet. So I don't think that there are any chips out there that are capable of doing that. Although the microchip is now being used, besides relocating pets, we now have microchip reading doors, like pet doors, so that only the pets that are chipped and have their chip number programmed in can get in and out of the pet door to keep things like raccoons and stray animals out of your house. So there's a number of things like that where they are being used, but not GPS to my knowledge. But look into that thing called the Tag. It may be something that would interest you.
Mm-hmm. I will. And then just a little aside story to advocate for chipping is that, you know, she's 12 years old now, and she's the best dog I've ever had. I've been able to leave her outside, and she comes and goes when she wants. But recently she has been, I'm not sure if it's dementia or some confusion, but she twice ran away. And our morning routine is she goes out, goes to the bathroom, and comes back in and eats.
Yeah, and you know, you really have to be careful with elderly pets, because sometimes they do have cognitive decline. Their vision may be impaired. Their hearing may be impaired. Their sense of smell may be impaired. All those things that are going to help keep them in your yard and, you know, bring them home to you could potentially be a problem. So this would be a case where I'd be really careful with your dog. If you've lost her twice, you know, you had to go hunt for her. You're very lucky that she, you know, didn't become coyote food or, you know, get hit by a car or anything like that. Traumatic could have happened.
Yeah.
Well, those days are over. I'm much more vigilant with her now.
Good, good.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
No problem.
Thanks, Joel. Thank you very much for calling. Good question. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And we did have a Facebook question from Morris, who says, I have a vaccine question. This year, our golden retriever got all of her vaccinations updated at the same time. She was fine the rest of the day and the next, but then started to have diarrhea for a couple of days. Should we
spread out
the vaccines?
Yeah, very, very good question. In fact, August is National Immunization Awareness Month, and I think this is actually a human thing, but veterinarians are taking advantage of it as well to promote pet vaccination and the importance of having your pet vaccinated. The vaccine reactions are one of those things that many people, not only in the human world, are afraid of, but in the pet world as well. And some of the things that we know are that vaccine reactions, the more vaccines you give the pet at one sitting, the greater the chance of having a reaction. There was a study done down in Florida where they looked at giving a single item vaccine, like maybe just a Lyme vaccine or something like that, versus giving multiple vaccines. And what they found is that in the pets that were given multiple vaccines, they had a 4 times increase in risk of vaccine reactions. It's still pretty low, about 27 animals out of 10,000 that were inoculated had that kind of reaction rate. So versus about 7 that got the single vaccine. And reactions are all over the place. I mean, we grade them on a scale of like classing them from 1 to 5 with, you know, 1 being something that the owner assumes is caused by the vaccine, but it may be all the treats that were given to your dog when it was such a good dog at the vet clinic. You know, so it may have been something like that. totally unrelated to the vaccine, to, you know, class two is lumps and swellings and things like that, where you have a painful response at the injection site. And I can say that when I've had tetanus vaccinations or flu shots, I've experienced those class two reactions, and they're considered to be fairly normal. Facial swelling is class three, or breaking out in hives, and that can be really problematic, especially if you've got a, like a push-faced dog. They could have trouble breathing, and then you get right up into the class five is anaphylaxis and potential death. So, you know, you've got all that range in there. So, whether your dog had a reaction that is noteworthy or not, this would be something to bring up with your veterinarian. What you may want to consider doing in the future is spacing out your vaccines. You want to have at least 2 weeks between any vaccine episode. So either clump them together or make sure that you're giving them at different times with at least a two-week interval between the vaccines. And also check with your veterinarian as to what kind of vaccines they're using. There's one multivalent vaccine that's very commonly used in the veterinary world that contains distemper and parvo and parainfluenza. It's called the DAP vaccine, but an adenovirus, which is a dog hepatitis. But they often throw in the same vial, leptospirosis, which is not a virus, but a bacteria. And one of the thoughts by the immunology folks is that when you start mixing viral components with bacterial components in the same syringe and give them in the same spot in the body, that seems to drive the allergic response more. So the big trend is to separate that lepto out. Even if you give it at the same visit in a separate location on the dog's body, you decrease the risk of having an allergic reaction. So lots of things to consider. I'm a big believer in, especially in small breed dogs, because they're more prone to having reactions, separating vaccines out. So bring this up with your veterinarian, and they may, you know, talk to you about doing some other things, separating them out, maybe doing vaccine titers, measuring your dog's immune response, which is a very valid thing to consider doing to make sure that you're only vaccinating if your dog needs it. I'm allergic to rabies vaccine, so I get my... The last rabies vaccine I got was in 1984, and I ended up in the hospital for a few days with hives and difficulty breathing and swallowing and so on. And I get my titers checked every couple of years, and I'm still protected since 1984. And so I just get it checked, and the joke at the clinic is the day my titer drops is the day I have to retire. So I hope it stays high for a long time.
Oh, I do too. Well, aside from, though, that's an obvious sign. But what about with your pet? Is there something to look for?
Yeah. I always talk to people about expected side effects and unexpected side effects. The expected side effects are going to be things like a little lethargy. They may be a little discomfort at the injection site. With the intranasal vaccines, they may do some sneezing or reverse sneezing, kind of snorting. Those are kind of things to be expected. The unexpected are, you know, profuse, very rapid onset vomiting and diarrhea, which can, you know, often then go right into anaphylaxis and shock, where their circulatory system starts to shut down. And if you don't have those emergency drugs there, you could potentially be in trouble. And those are usually like before the animal even gets out of the hospital. To the delayed response, which is hives and things, facial swelling and hives, which often responds very well to antihistamine. So there's a whole range of things that we can see.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jason Butler, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. We have an open line or two. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Judy in Brookfield has a question, so let's go to her. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question about the microchips. And if a pet is stolen or is really lost in a field or roadside, how effective is the microchip? I realize there are different companies manufacturing these microchips, and mine says if the pet is returned to a shelter or a vet, the microchip will locate the pet. But
yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, if the pet is really lost.
Yeah, you know, what we're hoping is that that lost pet that's in the field is going to be picked up by a Good Samaritan, taken to animal control or a humane society or a vet clinic, where any new intake is always scanned with the microchip scanner. Unfortunately, you have to be, you know, several inches or even closer to the dog or cat's body to be able to get that radio frequency to be admitted from the microchip when the scanner is passed over it. So out in the field, it's not going to do anything. And that's where that the previous caller was talking about having a GPS locator, which could be on a collar, but obviously not implanted into a pet. So, you know, they do serve a purpose, but you do have to have a scanner that allows it to be read.
I see. All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Tim in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sawchuk. I enjoy your program. And I just have a question. I have a seven, soon-to-be eight-year-old boxer that was urinating red or brownish.
Mm-hmm.
And it was doing that for a couple months. And my wife, you know, took it into the vet, and they did an ultrasound scan and found that he has about a 2-centimeter tumor in his bladder. And they wanted to do surgery right away. And, you know, I love my dog, but he's already almost 8 years old, and a boxer's expectancy is, you know, maybe a couple more years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I was wondering, is there anything that you know of, you know, medication-wise or even holistic things that we could try to help?
Yeah.
Maybe not get rid of, but help slow it down?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And unfortunately, bladder wall tumors are one of the tougher ones to treat. They typically are a transitional cell tumor that is the lining of the bladder wall. And going in and doing surgery to remove the primary source of it and is by far probably the best bet if it's in a spot that it can be removed. Unfortunately, it, you know, usually by the time they're diagnosed, they're, you know, they've spread to other, you know, it's through the bladder, and we just can't remove the entire bladder and have a functioning pet. You know, boy, there's some chemotherapy and things like that that can be done, but probably nothing that would be an over-the-counter product or anything that I can think of that would be, a herbal or products like that. But again, I don't practice that sort of medicine, and I would probably save that for talking to a veterinarian that does practice alternative care. But we do have an amazing oncology service at the School of Veterinary Medicine here in Madison. And there are always lots of different studies and things going on that many dogs and cats can be enrolled in. At this point, I don't know if there's anything regarding bladder wall tumors. But I think it might be worthwhile to give them a call and just say, hey, you know, what can we do? Or have your veterinarian call there and say, is there anything else that we can do to help this dog?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, and you know, when you say maybe only live a couple of years, when you really look at it, that's like 20% of the dog's life. And if someone told you that, hey, we're only going to get 20% more out of you, you'd probably be upset. Okay, so you know, look at those. If you know, who knows? I mean, we see a lot of dogs living, you know, much past their estimated life expectancy. So. And, you know, enjoy every day you have with your dog, but, you know, do look into it. Don't just sit on it and see if there is something that can be done, even if it's just pain control.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Darren a chance to join us as well. Darren, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for the show. I had a question about wild parsnip and its possible effect on dogs. In our backyard, we have a lot of land and trails and lots of wild parsnip. And I was just wondering, A, if dogs can react from wild parsnip the way a human can, and B, what can I do to either help prevent it or to clean up after we're in contact with the plant?
Yeah, you know, I'm sitting here just looking it up right now because there are so many plants that are out there that that can potentially be toxic, and wild parsnip is one of the,
It is one.
It is one.
The phytophotodermatitis on people, which causes, you know, the sunlight causes your skin to
blister and and so, you know, that would be, you know, again, depending on the coat density of your dog. I also wonder, is it possible for your dog to bring that in and inadvertently have you contact with it if they've been rolling in it or doing something? So, because we do see that with poison ivy at times as well. But I think you really need to probably check with a botanist or something to find out how to get rid of it safely from your yard. I don't know.
I do know the mechanisms to get rid of it. It's just a bigger project that I can take on this year.
Yeah. But I'd be having your dog avoid contact if possible. It's an invasive species, and it doesn't need to be there. But if you can, you know, maybe have your dog corralled in the front yard or something where there may not be as, you know, much risk of contact.
Good luck. Thank you, Darren, for calling. Appreciate it. We had a Facebook question from Daniel. He's talking to my dog breeder about allergies in dogs, and he mentioned some studies on selenium deficiency. Is there such a thing? And if so, what should I feed to supplement for it?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where I wish there could be an easy fix for dogs with allergies. We do know that it tends to be genetic. You know, labs, golden retrievers, you know, some of the terriers and so on, very common to see it running in families of dogs. And this would be something that you need to do your homework before you consider adopting a dog. That's always number one, is checking back several generations and see, did any of those dogs display any, you know, form of allergic skin disease. Selenium, to my knowledge, and again, it's I'm racking my brain from like 35 years ago in veterinary nutrition, is involved with fertility. And, you know, I know that it is bonded to certain proteins and so on, and it's been linked to some forms of heart disease, cardiomyopathy. It has some antioxidant activity, but really, you know, starting to supplement an already supplemented dog food is probably not going to be helpful for your pet. So I'd be looking at doing anything else you can to help control your dog's allergies, getting them allergy tested so that you can start immunotherapy. That's probably going to be your best bet for long-term control. You know, treating secondary infections, you know, bathing your dog more frequently, at least weekly, damp mopping your dog when they come in from outside to get rid of the contact irritants that may be on your pet. You know, those are all things that are going to be helpful. And one simple thing is washing your dog's bed more often, you know, at least weekly or so, washing the cover to get rid of any of that particulate matter that your dog's going to be laying and coming in contact with.
Question from an email from Marge, actually, who wonders, is there a best chip company out there? She heard that some are not reliable.
Yeah, and I think you really have to look at what you want your chip to do. If you are planning at all on traveling with your pet, especially overseas, you do need to have one that's called an ISO chip, international something, I don't know what it's, something organization, but it's, and those would be the ones that have the very long numbers, such as like the Home Again microchip. And you want one that is considered a universal chip as well. And there are some companies out there that they just, you know, they have their own unique reader, and you can't, you know, unless you've got the, you know, that particular scanner, you may not be able to pick it up. So I always advocate, you know, asking before the microchip is implanted, is this a ISO chip? Is this one that has can be read universal with a universal scanner that all animal control agencies and vet clinics should have there ready to use at any time? And there are, you know, one of the other advantages, there are one chip called the Home Again chip that has an anti-migration cap on it. I have seen some chip companies where it's implanted, and because it can be a little slippery, it maybe slides away from the shoulder area. And I've had a couple where I've found them down the leg or in a different spot in the body than when they were initially implanted. And that can be problematic. When we're scanning a stray pet, we scan every square inch of the dog's body or cat's body to try to find it in case they have one of these chips that's migrated. But something like the Home Again chip doesn't migrate. It has a little cap on the end that fibrous tissue can get, you know, hold it in place, and so it tends to stay right where we put it.
There you go. Let's turn to Kelly in Green Bay. Kelly, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. I heard from my breeder that, getting back to vaccinations, that the vaccine they use on my little toy breed is the same that they use on a large breed.
And that's
true.
They don't
go by the... It is.
It is true. Yeah, and that's, but you know, one of there has been talk about, should we be coming out with a small breed vaccine that is
exactly
dosed,
yeah,
differently? But the thought by immunologists is that an immune system is an immune system regardless of what it's packaged in. But I think that with small breed dogs, one of the best things that you can do is really look at, what does my dog need to be vaccinated for? Believe it or not, there are vaccines out there that one of our immunologists at the vet school uses the phrase, it's a vaccine that's looking for a disease. This is a vaccine called coronavirus that can be fairly reactive, and it is a very self-limiting disease. It is not one of these nasty ones like distemper or parvovirus that even requires a dog to be vaccinated for it. And yet there are many companies that still have that ingredient in the vaccine. So you always need to be, you have to be the advocate for your dog.
Okay.
I recommend that you, before you have your dog vaccinated, if you want to do a little, saying it in quotes, light reading, the American Animal Hospital Association's canine vaccine guidelines, a multi-page document that is pretty easy to understand, but it would be very helpful for you to maybe, you know, peruse that and have a look at it.
Okay.
For cat owners, the American Association of Feline Practitioners has posted their vaccine guidelines for cats as well.
Okay.
And I love it when an owner comes in well-educated and asks me these questions. But I think the best thing you can do for your dog right now is separate vaccines out and only use vaccines that are necessary for the lifestyle of your dog.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Kelly, for calling. We had another caller who wanted to know the consequences of not vaccinating your pets at all.
Well, let's see. What disease can we bring up? Well, one, rabies, it's the law. And having a pet that's not vaccinated for rabies, and if it bites somebody, you're going to be in big trouble for, and you have your options of either quarantining your dog or chopping its head off and having it evaluated for rabies, which is not a nice consequence, but it is the law to have your pet vaccinated. This is just for dogs. It's not a state law for cats. It's a local ordinance for cats. So here in the Madison area, cats and dogs need to be vaccinated to be legal. The other diseases, things like, we just had three dogs in the last week and a half or so that had parvovirus. And parvo is one of these diseases that, especially in very young or very old animals, can really wipe out their intestinal tract, their bone marrow. It has a high death rate unless it's intensive treatment. So when we're vaccinating, we typically are vaccinating for diseases where treatment is either impossible or very difficult and survival rate may be quite low. So, and these diseases are everywhere. I mean, we know that urban raccoons carry distemper that is contagious to dogs. And it's the same bug. And you have these dogs or the raccoons coming and visiting your porch at night. Who knows what they're leaving behind virus-wise or even bacteria-wise, something like leptospirosis. If you've got a dog that likes to swim, drink from puddles or ponds, again, that's one of those diseases that they need to be vaccinated for.
Sue in River Falls has a question for you. Hi, Sue. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. I lost my 15-month-old German Shepherd about 3 weeks ago to mesenteric torsion, and I would love to get another German Shepherd, but I know they're somewhat prone to this, and so I'm wondering if you could talk about torsion a bit and if there's anything you can look for in bloodlines to avoid it.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of these things where it is something that we see in German Shepherds, it is not that common, but unfortunately, it is often deadly by the time it's diagnosed. And what this is where all the intestines hang from the dog's back, and they're supported by these sheets of real thin tissue called mesenteries that, and the whole thing kind of just twists. And it would be like, you know, having, a big a knot in a sheet or something like that, where now all the blood supply to the majority of the intestinal tract is going to be impaired, and the intestines basically die, and there's usually nothing that can be done. If it's caught very early, you may be able to get some reperfusion if they go in for emergency surgery. One of the things that it has potentially been linked to is dogs with pancreatic insufficiency. When they don't produce enough pancreatic enzymes to digest their food, there seems to be a link between those two things. And so if you have a shepherd that is having some issues with gaining weight or has softer kind of chronic diarrhea stools, greasier stools, that would be one of the things that needs to be looked into and treated, because we do see sometimes a correlation between torsion like this and that particular digestive disorder. Probably a more common type of torsion that we see in all large breed dogs, and even some small breed dogs, but especially those that are really deep chested, is having gastric torsion, a dilation and torsion, right, where the stomach twists. That is definitely more common than what you're describing. And I'm so sorry that you lost your shepherd. Yeah. In my 35-year career, I've had two dogs that have had this, and that's it. So it's not, you know, and that I'm working at a big referral center. So it's, you know, we don't see it that often, but it is something, again, to make sure that the dogs that you're getting your dog from is a reputable breeder that, you know, it is not breeding dogs that potentially have this this problem with their pancreas.
Yeah.
Right. Well, my dog actually did have it. She had a tumor, which caused a pivot point in her intestine.
Okay.
One more question regarding that, though, is how is torsion diagnosed?
Well, these, you know, pets, if it's gastric torsion, usually they're coming in with non-productive vomiting. Their abdomen is going to be distended because the stomach looks bigger. They're often shocky. Because everything's torsed and you've decreased the blood flow through the intestinal tract, that does cause shock. It may interfere with blood flow to the heart and so on. And so you can start seeing these dogs having cardiac issues. Okay. So they present different ways, but, you know, anytime you've got a dog that is, you know, that's vomiting and you know, not looking good. I just had a dog in yesterday that ate a foreign body. The owner called and said, yeah, you know, it's a puppy that is just laying around, and normally he's not like this. And I'm like, get him in. And sure enough, he went in within like 2 hours, had emergency surgery done. So, you know, and it's, so you really have to know your dog, and if they're, right, their color's off, their abdomen's looking a little different, they're just, you know, not acting themselves, that's time to get them in.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you much.
Yeah. Thanks, Sue. You can join in too, by the way. We have open lines finally, and we can get you on at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your cat or dog question, health question. We'd love to hear from you. Chris in Janesville, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi. I listened to one of your previous shows when my dog was just a puppy. I have a female Springer Spaniel that just turned a year, and I want to have her spayed. And I heard you talk about the benefits of just removing the ovaries, but when I asked my vet about it, he doesn't do that. And he said, well, I don't see the point in leaving something dead, the uterus, just laying around in the body.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if I need to find another vet, bring her to the vet school. What would I be gaining if I have the ovaries?
Well, this is a really good question, because it is something that is being discussed in the veterinary world kind of more and more frequently. The standard procedure that we normally would do would be a midline incision on the abdomen and remove the ovaries and the entire uterus, and it's called an ovariohysterectomy. Obviously, because of the way the incision's made, you have to have a dog kept very quiet afterwards. You know, everything is removed. The big issue with that is just post-op complications. Even though spays are done every day, it is still major surgery. And so you need to follow your veterinarian's instructions with keeping your pet very quiet for the healing time to allow that incision to heal. The other procedure, which is just removing the ovaries, can often be done laparoscopically. And so this is where, if your veterinarian does not have that type of equipment, and I have to admit, there are not very many veterinarians that do laparoscopic surgery, but the ones that do it, I mean, you can have the advantage of smaller incisions, faster healing time. Often they can, at the same time, and they can do this when they're going in for a standard spay as well, is they can do a gastropexy for like the German Shepherd owner that just we just spoke with. Some dogs that are more prone to bloating and having their stomach twist, they can attach it to the abdominal wall to help prevent that from twisting. That is one of the advantages of having it removed. Now, probably the people that don't want to do this procedure are thinking that, well, if I leave the uterus in, they're more prone to having an issue with what's called a pyometra, or an infection in the uterus. To be able to have a pyometra, you have to have ovaries, and you have to have ovaries that are producing hormones. And if the ovaries are gone, a pyometra, it doesn't happen. It would be really uncommon to have that be an issue. The other thing would be a uterine cancer, which is extremely uncommon in dogs as well. So, you know, you are leaving that in there, but, you know, so there's pros and cons both ways. And I think that, you know, if you've got a super active dog that you're going to have a hard time keeping still, having it done laparoscopically may be in their best interest. But again, spays, you know, veterinarians that do hundreds of these every year have it down to having a small incision, and, you know, it is an art to being able to do it effectively and safely for dogs. And that's why I don't do surgery, because I would need big incisions to be able to find everything.
Would I be able to bring her to the UW clinic?
Absolutely. We have, it's open. You do not have to be referred by your veterinarian. We have a 24-hour emergency service available 365 days a year. We do spays and neuters. The standard spays and neuters are usually done on Mondays. Laparoscopic it might be done on Mondays as well, but that it's going to be a little more expensive because of the equipment that's going to be used. But we have a primary care service there. That's my service that people can come in with their pets just for routine care and day emergencies and, you know, common illnesses and so on. So it's and plus all the other specialties that are there as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, they're called Springers for a reason. So I'm going to go with the one that just removes the ovaries. Thanks
yeah,
a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for calling. And let's turn to a comment from Pete in Eau Claire, who said, I save a lot of money by vaccinating my Irish setters myself.
Very good question. This is something I bring up with my vet students all the time, too. And probably number one is it's illegal for you to, you can't have a dog that's been vaccinated for rabies unless it's been done by a veterinarian or under the direct supervision of a veterinarian by a licensed technician. So he can't, if he does a rabies vaccination himself, it's not looked at as valid. You can't get a tag. You can't get your dog licensed. So that's number one. Number two is when you start looking at vaccines that you can buy over the counter, have they been stored correctly? Just to give you an example, we walked in on Monday and the vaccine refrigerator, which is very carefully monitored to make sure that the temperature is kept right on, had died. And we were Monday morning, no vaccines, because it was 20 hours without being held at the right temperature. We threw out hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of vaccine and ended up having to borrow some from another clinic. But do you know if that vaccine was stored correctly? Did it sit on a loading dock while it was waiting to be put into the refrigerator at the pet store or at the farm store? I always laugh because when you look at the box of over-the-counter vaccines, it says, in case of an allergic reaction, administer epinephrine. And I have never seen an over-the-counter vaccine have a bottle of epinephrine actually in there. And I can tell you, when I've had dogs that have had serious reactions, if I didn't have critical care down the hall, they may not have made it. So, you know, I doing them at home, you really do run that risk if there is a problem. And your veterinarian can also help you with making sure that your dog is getting the right vaccinations at the right time, and giving them in the right location on the body. So lots of good reasons to be going to your veterinarian. And there's even some of the vaccines that are out there over the counter have ingredients in them that are not recognized as being safe. For example, mm-hmm. there's one called hepatitis that you'll see in many of the over-the-counter vaccines. What most veterinarians use is a vaccine that contains adenovirus 2, which cross-protects for hepatitis, has less reaction rate. And so the vaccine, like at our local farm store here, does have hepatitis in it, and you can run the risk of having a pretty serious eye problem called blue eye. It's an inflammatory response that can occur with that vaccine. Should be taken off the market, but it's still there.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, talking your pet's health. And Frank in Slinger has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Frank, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks for having me on. I'm so glad to have the show on today. I need your help.
Okay.
I have a 7-year-old Newfoundland. About 8 months ago, he started to get really, really itchy, a lot of dander produced, and would scratch himself bald at several places on his body to the point of producing blood. Took him to the vet. The vet thought it was a skin infection, put him on antibiotics and a steroid that, as soon as he came off the steroid, went back to itching. Now they did a blood test, and they said he's allergic to beef.
Okay.
I'm not saying I don't trust the vet, but it just seems like that's something the dog has always had since birth, essentially.
Yeah.
Is it normal for a dog to pick up an allergy later in life?
No, it isn't. And, you know, your classic dog that has allergies are going to be probably over a year of age, 2 years of age or so, when they really start peaking, and then they continually get worse. But the fact that your dog started later in life as a mature Newfoundland makes me really concerned. You know, most dogs with allergies are going to lick their feet, scratch their ears, but you're not going to see their body so much being affected. It can be, that's not your classic dog with allergies. What I really get concerned about is, being an older dog, is this something like cutaneous lymphoma, which is sometimes the name called mycosis fungoides. It might be something, just the fact that it's flaking so severely, it's bleeding, it's red, it's really bothering the dog, and it didn't respond to antibiotic treatment. It may be worthwhile looking into getting a skin biopsy done to be able to find out exactly what is going on there. When it comes to food allergies, the blood test includes food allergies is bogus. Like, it really is not the way to diagnose food allergies. We get a lot
I didn't want to hear that.
Yeah,
that's how we found out.
Yeah, we get a lot of very inconsistent reports back with that. If you want to rule out food allergies as a reason for your dog's discomfort, it would be to do an elimination diet trial. We usually is about 8 weeks or so of feeding a hydrolyzed protein diet. This would be one that would be a prescription or a therapeutic diet from your veterinarian. Hills makes one called ZD. Purina makes one called HA, hydrolyzed, or hypoallergenic diet. Royal Canin makes a couple of them. These are not going to be available over the counter. And you feed that and only that for a good, 8 weeks or so, and then you can either challenge the dog or see, if the dog got better, just keep them on that diet all the time. They're usually made from chicken, and they take that chicken protein and break it down into little tiny bits that the dog's body doesn't recognize where it came from. One of the issues that I've had recently is there's a number of companies that are coming out with over-the-counter what are called limited antigen diets. There are things like venison and potato or rabbit and green pea. And it's unfortunate, but they, even though they plan on only having limited ingredients in it, they are made in a place that handles other proteins. I was just at a coffee shop bakery today, and there was a big sign by the cash register saying, you know, we work in a kitchen that, you know, works with nuts and dairy products and eggs, and so we can't guarantee that our other products aren't going to be contaminated with these things. So if you have an allergy, be careful. Well, that's the same thing with the pet food, is most of them are contaminated with other ingredients, so you can't use the over-the-counter diets as a way of determining whether your pet has a food allergy. I just don't think that that's, well, yeah.
That's kind of interesting, because I've got a Labrador Retriever as well, and we've had him for probably the last 18 months, had him on a fish and potato diet.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, they're not even on beef. The very little beef that they would get,
uh-huh.
I can't imagine what makes him freak out this bad. But, and he's like bald from his shoulders to his haunches on both sides.
Yeah, and I think, you know, really doing some skin scrapings to look for external parasites. Both dogs would probably be affected. You know, you may even want to consider a visit to a dermatologist just to be able to get to the bottom of this. Sounds like your dog is miserable, and
yeah.
We need to get some answers.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a good boy. It kind of breaks my heart every
time. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Boy.
Good luck, Frank.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. Well, that's tough.
Yeah.
I'm
itching just thinking about it.
Scratching myself here.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Lynn, how about you in La Crosse? Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have two mini doxies, just over 3 years old, and I have to take them every, 6-8 weeks, couple months, to the vet to have their anal glands expressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, is this something that I will have to do for the rest of their lives, or is there something that I can use diet-wise to help this go more naturally?
Yeah, the anal glands sit on either side of the rectum, and are just, they usually get expressed when the dog has a BM. And if you've got a dog that's producing less frequent bowel movements or softer stools, they may fill up. And so one of the theories is, you know, bulking up the diet with extra fiber and so on to see if that makes a difference. So switching over to a light diet that's a high fiber diet, reading the bags and just going with one that's got a higher percentage fiber in it, potentially may be helpful. I've not had much luck with doing that. I think it's always worth trying because it's not going to hurt the dog. I think what you probably are dealing with is just the fact that you have dachshunds. I used to have basset hounds, which are just bigger versions of dachshunds with their long back and short legs. And anatomically, if you look at the way a dachshund or a basset hound is built, besides the obvious thing with the short legs, everything seems to be kind of shifted forward. And so I think what happens is, instead of the glands emptying as stools going through, it's actually compressing the duct and preventing them from emptying. Both my basset hounds, I had their anal glands removed. I just said, I'm tired of dealing with this. It got to be a weekly event. And even though everything was normal for them, it's just not a fun thing to have to go through. So I have taught owners that, you know, like you, how to do it themselves if you aren't afraid of doing a rectal exam on your dog and you've got someone there that can help hold them. I've gone through lessons and have owners that have a box of gloves and just do it themselves at home. It's a pretty easy procedure. The thing that you don't want to be doing is expressing them externally, because that can actually cause more damage to the duct and the glandular tissue by increasing pressure. And that's typically the way a lot of groomers do it. And so, you know, you want to do it rectally. And so that would be the other option, is have your veterinarian show you how to do it.
Okay.
All
Thank
right.
you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much.
She didn't sound very enthusiastic
I'm with Lynn. I wouldn't be very enthusiastic about it either. It's not something that I would want to do. I can tell you that for free.
That's why I'm glad I have veterinary students working with me, because it's I can have them do it. Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, we have Eric in Endeavor with a question. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Hey, Sandy. I have a question. I have a blue heeler, and she's got what kind of looks like a heat rash on her inner thighs and her back legs where she doesn't have hair. Is that possibly what that could be? She got like three or four little scabs that put Neosporin on it, and it cleared, started clearing up. But I only did that for like 2 days, and they're starting to come back.
Yeah, and any of those hairless areas, especially if you've got some skin folds or skin on skin contact, you can get some irritation. Typically, it's not like a heat rash, but it's usually a skin infection, usually a staph infection. They'll get folliculitis or inflammation of the hair follicles, and that might be what you're seeing, especially the fact that they scabbed over a little bit. You can use, if it's only two or three little spots, a little antibacterial soap, the Neosporin like you're using, if it helps get rid of it. If it's spreading, then we're usually looking at having to jump to big gun antibiotics to try to get it under control.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And on to Deb in Fond du Lac. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question. I had purchased the Budgie from a PetSmart store, and they had recalled them for psittacosis, the chlamydia.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that can be transferred to dogs, because my dog has been having issues kind of about the same time. I'm not sure exactly if it started at the same time, but it's, and he is 11 and a half, 12 years old. And he's currently overnight at the referral center in Appleton for he's got
That's okay. I've never heard of it being an issue with dogs.
So it's rare.
Yeah,
okay.
I'd be looking for some other reason why your dog is sick and not be too worried about the bird.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. I just kind of wanted to double check.
Yeah,
no problem. Thank you very much for calling, Deb. And we had another caller who wondered, how is your dog Petey doing?
Oh, he's wonderful. He's getting big. He's losing all those baby teeth. He is just a wonderful, socialized, happy dog. It's my first puppy I've had in years that I've been able to, mold how I want. And right now he's currently having a play date with his sister and his mom and his auntie. So I'm going to come home to a tired dog this afternoon. Yeah.
And he's an
English bulldog. Yeah.
English bulldog.
Yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or post a photo of your pet on my Facebook page. I'd love that as well. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And we'll be back with Sandy right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller Hill. Here, just like people, our pets are healthy most of the time if we're lucky, but when they're sick or they get injured, you want to have them get the best help possible. And we have great help for you today in Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Sandy, always great to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Nice to be here.
We have lots of calls online, and there was a question that came up earlier about psittacosis. And you wanted to
comment. I just wanted to update on that. I didn't get a chance to talk about it. It is one of those diseases that is quite serious in people if they get exposed. And during the break, I did look up, and it can be transmitted to dogs, although it's uncommon. Dogs usually get it from either ingesting a dead bird or ingesting contaminated fecal material. Or potentially by aerosol, aerosol and developing, they can develop a pretty serious pneumonia type symptoms. So I kind of misspoke where I said I didn't think it happened in dogs, but it can. It's just uncommon.
Let's turn to a caller and Ron in Grand Marais, Michigan, up next. Ron, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I have a question. I'm a little confused on vaccinations that are supposed to be good for 3 years. I thought I've heard on your show before, like rabies, distemper, and parvo.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to another vet that said they give them yearly and they're not good for 3 years. Are there different vaccines that are good for only 1 year or 3 years, or are they really good for that whole 36 months.
Yeah, that's one of those things that we see is, like, depending on, like, the rabies vaccine you're talking about, there, when you're looking at a killed rabies vaccine that's labeled for 1 year versus 3 year, the only thing that's different about the vials is the label. And they're labeled like that to meet different local ordinance requirements. So, you know, there really is no difference, although there is a rabies vaccine for cats that is a totally different brand and type of vaccine called a canary pox vector vaccine, where there is a big difference because they've now just recently come out with a 3 year version of it, and it's very different than the 1 year, manufactured differently, and you know, so you are getting something very different. Most of the things like the distemper vaccinations, distemper parvo combination vaccines, again, it often just comes down to the label that's on it. Some are labeled for 1 year, some are labeled for 3 years, and when in a pinch, we've used the 1 year labeled vaccines and had it be a 3 year vaccine if we needed it in some of our adult dogs. So there really isn't any big difference. It's just the label for the most part, except for that one incident with the cat vaccine that I just mentioned, the new rabies vaccine called PureVax. I do recommend that you go to the American Animal Hospital Association's canine vaccine guidelines and have a look at that, and you know, bring it in and talk to your veterinarian about it, because that is something that, again, if your veterinarian feels that they have to do something every year, it may be that you're living in an area that has a much higher distemper rate or a much higher parvo rate, where they feel that would be better to inoculate the dog more frequently. But the general guidelines are for adult dogs to do those viral vaccines every 3 years. Still, there's still some vaccines like leptospirosis and Lyme vaccine and kennel cough that do require inoculations every year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the rabies vaccine, even if they say it's a 1 year, it should be good for 3 years.
It is, yeah. But if, but again, you have to look at what the law is. When we vaccinate a puppy, or the first time a dog has ever had, even if it's an adult animal, if it's never had a rabies vaccine, you are obligated by law to revaccinate again that dog a year later. Then you can go every 3 years. So in our puppies at the vet school, we use a 3 year labeled vaccine, you know, IMRAB 3 or whatever, and then have them come back in again a year later for a booster vaccination, and then that one is good for 3 years. So we use the 3 year labeled, but we have to follow what the laws are and redo it again a year later.
I got you. Thank you very much.
It's complicated. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for calling. And Harv in Washburn, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. Yeah, I'm wondering if there's anything like a subdermal implantable contraceptive that would do away with spaying and the surgery and all that.
That, I, you know, there is talk about coming up with a vaccine that is going to work on the ovaries in dogs. To my knowledge, that's not available yet, but it's a, like, I think it's called a zona pellucida vaccine. I don't think that it is commercially available. We do have the injectable sterility inducing drug for dogs, and it used to be called Nutrisol, and it's been given a different name now, but that is available, that is injected into the testicular tissue so that you can avoid having, you know, full surgery done in these dogs. But, you know, again, you've still got the issue of the dogs are going to be producing some male hormone and may have some, you know, behavior changes and so on associated with that. There, it makes them sterile, but they may still have some virility issues. But not to my knowledge, unless somebody can, one of my vet colleagues out there knows something that I don't think there is anything available for female dogs.
All right. There we go. Thanks for calling, Harv. And on to Colin in Hartford. Hi, Colin.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks for calling.
I have a 2-year-old chocolate lab male, and back in spring I took him in for his yearly shot and mentioned to my vet that he was not eating all the time. And he ran a series of tests, and it came back with copper liver disease.
Okay.
How often should I be having that checked, and what can I do to bring his copper levels down.
Well, we're usually when we've got some type of a copper storage disease, it is considered to be an inherited disease for some breeds of dogs. We do see it, you know, if I had to pick a breed, Bedlington Terriers are probably the poster child for having that typical problem. But it's one of those things where you're probably looking at primarily using specialized diets that are low in copper so that there's less copper being able to go into the liver and cause problems. And these would be diets that would be available through your veterinarian. There's one that Hills makes called LD. It's a liver diet that is a low copper diet, and that may buy your dog some time. When it comes to how often you should be having your dog checked and check those liver values, it really depends on how sick your dog was at the initial testing and how they're doing. Usually when I'm working with a dog with liver disease, we're checking monthly for the first little while, and then we can, you know, go longer between episodes depending on how the dog is doing.
Sure, because his liver, the copper count was in the mid-500s, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and I think I don't know how well copper storage disease can be diagnosed without having a liver biopsy done. That would be something that I don't know if that was done to be able to get an accurate diagnosis of copper storage disease, but that's typically how it's diagnosed.
There we go. Thanks.
What is the side effects going to be from it? Because he seems to be a normal 2-year-old lab. He tons of energy. He's a good solid 80 pounds.
Yeah, you know, and I'm really concerned about the diagnosis because dogs with copper storage disease that aren't being treated are going to go into liver failure fairly quickly. It's one of those things where they're not going to live a long time. And the fact that your dog is doing fine, I'm really questioning the diagnosis and how it was actually diagnosed.
Yeah. In this case, would you maybe a second opinion?
I'd get a second opinion. I think that would be a good idea. Take all your lab tests, biopsy results, everything that's been done, and have someone else have a look at it.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks, Colin, for calling. Appreciate it. And we'll give Mike and Fort Atkinson a chance next. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Yeah, thank you. I have just a great Australian Shepherd and Lab mix. She's 5 years old. And it was probably about a week ago that I noticed she has beautiful golden eyes, and I noticed that one is dilated and one is contracted.
Hmm.
And they both react to sunlight.
Okay.
And I'm just really puzzled about this because she, as far as I know, there has been no trauma. The only thing that I can even think of that happened around that time was that she just got her complete set of shots.
Okay. Yeah.
Came after.
Yeah, and I really can't think of how vaccines would cause that. I mean, when we see different pupil sizes, sometimes it's actually a problem with the eye itself where you may have some inflammatory change or something going on inside the eye. Alternatively, it could be something affecting the nerves of the running to the eye. There are some nerves that, you know, run near the ear and so on, where we can have a condition called Horner's syndrome that can cause an abnormal pupil size on one side compared to the other. And so when we get a dog in with this kind of thing, we jump through doing a complete neurologic exam to see if there are any other cranial nerves or other nerves of the body that could be affected. I have seen some dogs that have had, especially older dogs, and this happens probably more often in cats, something called iris atrophy, where the colored part of their eye starts to disintegrate and it changes the shape and the size of the pupil as well. And that's just considered kind of a normal age-related change, and it's not due to any pathology that would cause the dog some harm. But this would be something I would take your dog into your veterinarian. Your dog needs a good, thorough eye evaluation and check over all those cranial nerves to make sure that there isn't anything else going on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She's just been such an asset. I bought her for $15 at a flea market 5 years ago, and she was born on February 14th.
Oh.
And she has just been What a super dog.
Well, it just goes to show you, you know, it's not how much you paid for the pet that gives you the value of the pet. It's all, you know, what you put into it and what the dog gives you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And with that, we will turn to Joe and Slinger. Hi, Joe.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm calling about my Westie. I have a 10-year-old female Westie that has some issues with her eyes. That is, frequently on a daily basis, they kind of get clouded over with a material, and we clean it manually, and we use eye drops, and she cooperates and all. I don't know whether it's an allergy kind of related thing or an age related thing, but I'm just curious what you can tell me about it.
Yeah, a lot of times when dogs get older, their tear production changes and they start making fewer tears, or the quality of the tears that they make also changes. And it can result in them having kind of goopy eyes frequently that need to be cleaned. I'm not sure if you've gone to your veterinarian to have an eye exam done, but one of the things that we routinely check when we do an eye evaluation is something called a Schirmer tear test, which is little pieces of calibrated filter paper that we just put, you know, just inside the eyelid and suck up the tears for a minute and look at how many millimeters are measured on this little piece of paper, and to see if your dog is producing normal tear production. That would be my number one thought, is that your dog has something like dry eye going on. And it's a very simple test, and it's something that can often be either, you know, managed or treated effectively using there's certain drugs. There's one in the human world that it goes by the name of Restasis, but in dogs there's I'm drawing a blank on the name of it. Optimmune is what it's called, and it's basically the same thing as the Restasis in people.
Okay, well, very good. I appreciate your help. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had lots of Facebook photos, by the way, so some really cute ones. But Jim on Facebook posted a picture of his kittens, which are quite cute, and Gil and Rosie, and he asked, what should we discuss at the kittens' first vet visit?
This is one of those topics where I actually have an entire page of things that when a vet student's going in and working with me with a new kitten owner, things that need to be discussed. We would want to be covering things like microchipping, spaying and neutering, size of litter box to use, how many litter boxes you should have, vaccines, nutrition, other behavior issues like how to deal with scratching, appropriate play with your cat, things to be looking for that would be signals that your cat's health is having some issues, anything that we happen to find on physical exam that may be abnormal would need to be discussed as well. So these are, you know, all things that you going in and saying, okay, doc, how many litter boxes do I need? How many, you know, having all those things lined up, especially if you've had the cat for a little bit, where you've said, hey, you know, it is scratching on the furniture. I wonder what I can do. We'll sometimes do things like show owners how to trim nails, talk about appropriate grooming tools. I mean, it's endless. I mean, we can, you know, and I think that's having that kind of relationship with your veterinarian. I don't know how someone can get through a 10 or 15 minute office call. With new kittens, I spend an hour with a client to be able to answer all those questions.
Oh, wow. And you've got the list for
I have it all printed out and laminated so that if a student goes in and is talking to the owner, those are things that are really important to address.
Lillian in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. I have a question. My cat tends to be allergic to beef. Whenever I feed that to him, he scratches by his face and near his ear, and I've noticed when I stay away from that, he doesn't do that, and he gets along better. I feed him Friskies cat food, and most all of the kinds in it will say meat byproducts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if that includes beef.
It can. Anytime that they don't identify the a species of the animal that the food came from, you have to assume that the offending ingredient may be in there. And so, you know, byproducts are the edible, cleaned, free of hides, hooves, hair, ingesta, you know, parts of the animal that, we may not want to eat, like the tripe and the lungs and the thymus and so on. But it's still nutritionally sound material, but it could come from anything. And that's the problem with using over-the-counter diets, that you have to be a label reader and then also worry, you know, did this food get manufactured in a plant that was dealing with beef prior to making this seafood diet or chicken diet? And because it may still be contaminated. So, you know, being a label reader, if your cat truly does have a food allergy, you may want to talk to your veterinarian about one of the limited antigen diets that are out there. There are some that are, I really like the Royal Canin products for cats. They have a rabbit and green pea and a venison and pea, and there's a number of different ones that are out there that cats seem to like and really respond well to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Could I ask another quick question?
Sure.
I have a young cat that's about 3 years old, and he is scratching on my carpet all the time. He does have two scratching posts that he uses occasionally, but like when he gets up and how they always stretch,
mm-hmm.
he decides that he wants to scratch on my carpet.
Oh, cats scratch. There's three reasons why they do it, maybe even more, but three that I can think of. One is, like you've noticed, just the stretching. And when they wake up or they get up from a nap, they may stretch and extend their claws and so on, and that can cause some damage. They also claw to leave a visual mark behind, so it is a form of marking, so that when people walk into your house, they can say, oh, you have cats, or another cat comes into your house, they know that he lives there. And they're also leaving their scent behind, and that because they've got scent glands in their feet as well. They also use it to hone their claws, to get the husks off the outside of their claws. Couple of things that you may want to try: really look at where those scratching posts are located. Often we will hide them in a place, we'll put them next to the litter box, we'll have them out of the way. You want to have it be a really in a socially significant area. In this case, where your cat likes to sleep, and having scratching posts available. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a scratching post. It could be a scratching pad. They do make some that are like horizontal that you can lay on the ground. And some cats like to be, you know, vertical scratchers, and some like horizontal scratchers.
I tried the pad and he doesn't use it. He scratches right alongside of it.
And then it comes down to trimming his claws, learning how to do that. It's actually quite easy. Or putting on soft paws as a way of preventing the cat from being able to damage the furniture, because the nails are covered with these little plastic nail caps. And then lastly would be declawing, which would be something you would need to be talking to your veterinarian about.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Nell in Milwaukee, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. So I have a very old dog. She's almost 17, who's in kidney failure. She's been in kidney failure for about 6 months, I'd say, and I think that's probably a long time. I manage it with subcu fluids, and she's now at a point, and has been for quite a while, but it's worse, of, you know, I fix six or seven different things for her to eat, and she puts it in her mouth, spits it out, you know, takes another bit. I managed to get her... Mm-hmm. A Nelepril in her every day, and maybe a tablespoon, maybe two tablespoons. She's a mini doxy, so she doesn't need a lot, but she's losing a lot of weight. Any last-ditch something? Is there anything left?
My goodness. You know, we don't do kidney transplants in dogs. It is something that can be done in cats. When we have them get really bad, sometimes we need to go through intravenous fluids and kind of dialysis type treatment. But again, it's one of those things where a decision's going to have to be made eventually. I mean, it sounds like your dog's being managed It's on enalapril. I would assume that's because your dog was either hypertensive or passing protein in the urine. You know, monitoring blood pressure, maybe putting your dog on some gastroprotective agents. Those would be things that we might be able to be, you know, make your dog feel better. But I think it's going to be one of those things we have to assess quality of life on a daily basis.
And I wish we had more time now.
I know.
I'm so sorry that we don't. But I appreciate your call. Something for you to think about. And Dr. Sandy, we'll look forward to your next visit. You're back with us on September 9th.
I am.
Appreciate your call. And thank you all for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more good things in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.